Oh, my name is Bob Welsh, and currently I am playing keyboards and guitar with the Fabulous Thunderbirds and Elvin Bishop. And right now you're listening to Talking Blues.
I want to begin with your grandmother.
Okay.
She was musical. Tell me a
Yeah,
little
yeah.
bit about your grandmother.
Well, she was a fabulous piano player and organ player, and she was playing in churches and silent movie theaters, making sound effects for the trains and everything like that, And but she was great, and but she died before I started even playing the piano. But she definitely was an influence because there was always music going on in the house,
What kind of music did she play?
She played, she could play boogie woogie, which she rarely did, and she just did like, show tunes and reading music, Gershwin, Cole Porter, the kind of popular music from her time. I remember hearing
I
that.
presume you didn't get a chance to watch her work the theater
No.
magic. That would have been way.
That would have been killer. I saw her in church, and she would kick with her feet. She really knew how to play the B3 as well, and she was terrific.
But that's not the reason why you play keyboards.
I started playing guitar first, and the reason I'm playing keyboards is because Rusty Zinn convinced me to do it, because he heard me just kind of messing around, and he thought that maybe I had a nice feel on it. And he said if I could learn how to play, that I could join his band on the road. And I wanted to go on the road more than anything. So I learned how to play.
How long did that take for you to play at a level that you could tour with Rusty
About
Zinn?
6 months, I'd say. I just
Wow.
went down to the basement and practiced. And he gave me a tape that had like Big Maceo, Little Brother Montgomery, all the stuff that I hadn't heard before. And he was telling me, okay, learn this, and when I he was very gracious to take me on the road because I really could only play in a few keys when I went on the road, it seemed like. But playing live definitely helps your playing, and so does the recording studio. And I just learned pretty quickly.
Okay, so at this point, when you started picking up the piano, you had already started playing, you had already played the bass and the guitar.
Yes.
Were you a good guitar and bassist?
I was a pretty decent guitar player, but I wasn't on Rusty's level by any means at that time. But I was learning from him. I was taking guitar lessons from him. And
And that's this was your first official guitar lesson, right? Like,
yes, yeah. But I taught myself how to play as a teenager, and I met Rusty when I was like 23, and he gave me about four or five guitar lessons, and after the last one, he says that I was showing him stuff to play, and that he couldn't teach me anything anymore or something.
That's why he told you to play the piano.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, I. Because I don't want any more competition. I want, play some keyboards.
If we go back, tell me how, I mean, it sounds like there was music around you all the time when you were growing
Yeah.
up. How did you first get into playing music?
I would say because I was a Beatles fanatic, and I had a guitar that I could barely play, that it was a my dad's guitar, and he couldn't play at all. It was a Gibson acoustic guitar, and somebody got me a Beatles book with all the chords in it, and I had an epiphany where to look at the chords and figure out how to play it. And pretty soon, I knew just about every Beatles song there was, and then I got into the blues like right after.
How old were you at this point?
14.
Okay, so 14's pretty early to get into the blues. What do you think it was about the blues that hooked you?
To be honest with you, it was the Blues Brothers movie because I'd
Okay,
never heard it,
I've heard that before.
and seeing John Lee Hooker blew my mind. Like it just sounded so great, you know. And I went out and bought John Lee Hooker records and soon moved on to Muddy Water and Sonny Boy. I mean, I was into it. I was like looking for, you know, reading about what to buy.
Let's say you've kind of figured out how to play chords Beatles songs. When you see John Lee Hooker and you go buy John Lee Hooker records, is it easy to figure that out? Can you just listen to it and go, oh, that's what he's doing?
Oh, well, at that point, I was really trying to figure it out, you know, and that's why Rusty helped me so much, because I learned what I thought was correct, you know, by rote. And then Rusty learned from Luther Tucker, and he was like, no, here's how you play the right part, you know. And it took me a, you know, it's not easy to really play it right, because you got to play it with feeling and have all the right tone and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, it's more than just strumming a chord or a note.
Yeah, I think it's a lot, you know, it's different than playing Nowhere Man, you know.
At what point did you think you wanted to pursue music in a serious way?
I fantasized about it as a teenager, but I didn't really pursue it until my early 20s. And then when I met Rusty and started, you know, playing music for a living, basically, and I just went into it.
Can you share that fantasy as a teenager, what that fantasy would have looked like?
That fantasy would have been like, you know, me playing all my favorite music live, you know. I mean, I used to just sit around and wish I was playing the Beatles songs or, you know, the Rolling Stones. And then, of course, John Lee Hooker and Muddy Waters, too. And it was a pretty convoluted fantasy.
But would this have taken place in a bar, in a stadium, in a
stadium.
Arena?
The stadium, yeah, for sure.
Okay, and then you lived in New Orleans for a little while. You went back to New Orleans.
I did. I grew up.
Tell me about that experience.
I grew up in Louisiana, and I lived there for about 10 years, from the age of about 7 to 17, and then I moved back there when I was 21, and I was living in the French Quarter, and. I lived in like an apartment complex. The first floor was like a transvestite bar, and the second floor was a voodoo couple with a boa constrictor in the hallway, and I had the third floor.
And you were the weird one.
Yeah, I was the strange one. But I was just trying to think of, you know, I was romanticizing about, you know, I'm living in Louisiana again, maybe I can play some music and meet some people, but. For one reason or another, I didn't. I mean, I was working as a dishwasher at some point and at an old folks' home, and I was playing music on the street. I mean, I was, you know, for money, I was just playing whatever songs I knew.
What was that like?
Well, it was kind of disheartening because I didn't have the skills of like a New Orleans proper musician, you know? I mean, I was just playing some Robert Johnson stuff, and then I'd play a Beatles song for someone walking by, just hoping that they throw a dollar into my, you know, guitar case. So I didn't really, you know, it wasn't like you'd think it would be me living in Louisiana, because I didn't start playing in a blues band until I moved back to California and met Rusty. But I formed my own band when I moved back to California. And
it was definitely blues.
It was definitely blues all the way. Yeah. 100%. I was into like Little Walter, and I was looking for a harmonica player, and I had even recorded like a demo tape, and was, you know, I was doing like Bill Jennings tunes, and it was definitely blues all the way.
So was going on the road to Rusty the first road experience?
It was the second. The first road experience was a woman named E.C. Scott. And she's like a gospel singer from Oakland.
Right.
And the only reason I got the gig is because Rusty couldn't do it. So he recommended me.
So Rusty's played a big part in your life.
Oh, he has.
He's and probably like, continues to, right?
He still does. I'm going to see him in May. We're doing a recording session in Vienna with this great bass player and piano player named Danny Googles. And he's been just recording his artists from America and from Europe too, and kind of making these killer vintage sounding records. And Rusty's so good at, you know, all those guitar parts, and he's got such a great voice. And I'm just, he just kind of, you know, hired me too along the ride. So,
is this a blues or reggae album?
This is blues all the way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cause I did notice that he's on tour playing blues right now, or
he
is going to be.
He's been working a lot in Europe, and which is, I'm really happy for him, because Rusty's so good at, you know, playing blues as well as reggae. But you know, he's living in Brazil now.
Yeah.
And he can go to Europe for several months and make a bunch of money, and then come back and live in Brazil for the whole year, you know, pretty much. So,
and in Brazil, is he doing the reggae thing in Brazil?
I believe he is, but I don't know. He works infrequently there, so I don't know when his last reggae gig was.
Right. Okay. So you go on tour. What's that experience like compared to that fantasy you had as a teenage kid?
It was a lot different. I didn't know any of the guys in the band. And halfway during the tour, we're listening to something on the radio, and it was like some U2 song. And E.C. Scott's like, "That's how I want you to sound like, you know, like The Edge, you know." And I'm like, I had a Les Paul and a Fender Bassman with a reverb tank, you know. I'm like, I can't sound like that. Sorry. I never got hired again from her.
And then you join Rusty's band as a keyboard player.
Yeah.
Tell me that experience.
Well, that was great. But I also, he let me play guitar as well, you know. And it was just exciting playing music I loved, you know, and I always got along great with Rusty. We got along great on the road. And we had Richard Innes playing drums.
One of the greats.
One of the greats, man. And he was great to travel with, real professional. And, but I just remember getting my ass kicked every night on guitar by Rusty, you know, and I learned a lot. He was
okay. So yeah. What's that like when what does that mean when you're getting your ass kicked? And then what does that feel like?
It feels just kind of like, oh man, I just can't play at his level. You know, I'm like, Rusty was so fluent on the guitar, you know, and I was just kind of starting out. And sometimes, you know, I'd be like, oh wow, I think I matched him tonight, at least, you know, and it's sounding good. But it took me a long time just to learn how to play, you know, fluently to where it pleases me, at least, you know.
I mean, I guess that's part of the learning process, and I presume everybody goes through this.
Yeah, absolutely.
But how do you?
But I think Rusty was a natural on the guitar right off the bat, from what I hear.
So are you playing leads with him, or are you just playing rhythm?
Both. He was very generous, you know. That's the way to learn, I suppose.
And then when you finish the tour, like, what have you walked away with? What did you learn, and how can you quantify that first tour and what you might have walked away with?
I think I might have just figured out what I was practicing at home, what I was able to utilize live, you know, like just making solos work, and how to accompany Rusty. That's what I learned the most thing is often I'd be playing piano crazy, and I learned not to play over his vocals when he's singing, you know, so just simple things like being an accompanist. I think I learned, hopefully learned by that first couple of tours.
But is that something that he talks to you and says, you know, you're playing over my singing too much, or
yeah,
or
yes,
gives you a dirty
absolutely
look? And
he never gave me a dirty look. He would talk to me and say, "Hey, just play between the vocals." And he also, you know, gave me some good advice. That being among one of them. But he was one of the first guys to on the piano, like, "Hey, just, you know, you can play a lot of stuff right now and just start off slow and kind of like less is more." And which I still try to keep in my periphery, you know.
Okay, so tell me about that concept, because I think I read somewhere about you seeing B.B. King.
Yeah, yeah. B.B. King came out and played one note, just went ding, and I was like the best guitar solo I ever heard, you know. It's like, meaning that, like, less is more, because if you play it with feeling, it can be really, it can hit you really hard, as opposed to like a, you know, maybe like a 12-year-old virtuoso who maybe doesn't have the feeling behind
right.
the playing, you know.
But I just wonder, how easy is it to do less is more, you know, to know the idea and go, yeah, I don't need to stick in 12 notes here, but you know, if you put two, if they're not the right notes, it doesn't mean it's better.
Right. You know, it's, I feel like it's something that I'm still learning. I try to keep that in my head and try to play some, you know, bold, but not just play a bunch of notes, you know. And it's just always, I'm always thinking about it, you know, when I'm playing. So I just, some things, you know, you just keep learning.
So you go on to play with a lot of different people, like Elvin Bishop.
Yeah.
Like Charlie Musselwhite.
Yep.
Kim Wilson. How does... What was the first big break you had? Like, what was the first connection you made with a legend, I guess?
It was with Charlie Musselwhite. And once again, Rusty helped me get that gig. Because he knew Charlie, and he was looking for a keyboard player. And I was in school at the time. I was, like, thinking about quitting music altogether.
What were you going to school for?
English Lit.
With the hopes of teaching, writing...
I was thinking maybe I could be a technical writer, or I didn't know really. I just wanted to finish it, and I only had about, you know, 15 more units to get my bachelor's degree.
Right.
And that, and I'd kind of given up on music. I'd quit Rusty's band, and I wanted to, like, it, man. I just kind of was just pursuing it and seeing if I could do something else with my life, you know, because. For whatever reason, being a musician, I wasn't sure if it didn't seem like it was going anywhere, you know.
Must have been, I mean, I can't imagine how difficult that would be to have this dream growing up of being a musician, having had some experience playing with musicians, but not making it really work for you.
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, Rusty got on Alligator Records. But he, you know, they didn't give him a really good advertising or a decent booking agent, and he was struggling out there. And Richard didn't want to tour. The bass player quit and joined Little Charlie and the Nightcats, you know. And I was like, well, shoot, I don't want to be in my 30s and not have anything to show for it. I think I better get a degree and try to, you know, do something different in my life. But then. I got the call to audition for Charlie, and I got really excited. My hope came back, and I was so happy when I got that gig.
So what is it about? So at that point, did you think you had, I mean, did you give up music completely, or did you still play, practice while you studied?
I was still playing. I was playing with a guy, a soul singer named Jackie Payne, while I was in college, and I would play on the weekends with him. I was playing keyboards.
And so were you at this point more of a keyboard player than a guitar player?
I it's funny because there's so many guitar players out there. So to this day, I get more keyboard work than anything. The fact that I can do both, you know, keeps me employed. But at that time, like, oh, Bob plays keyboards, you should hire him, you know. So there weren't that many keyboard players.
And if I was to ask you... When you think of yourself as a musician, do you think of one over the other, or are you just both keyboard and guitar?
I feel like I have a greater facility on the guitar, but I have a very great knowledge of Chicago blues, piano, and other things, but I'm not classically trained. Not on the guitar either, but I think I know just more on the guitar, but I'm learning more on the keyboards still, because I always have to practice for something. So I don't know.
And do you think in terms of one or the other?
I don't.
Like when you hear music, do you hear it as a guitar player or a piano player?
I probably hear it on the guitar, I suppose. But, you know, I love both. I love both.
Okay, so you get this gig with Charlie Musselwhite. Tell me what that's like.
That was a lot of fun. I mean, he was a great, he still is a great guy. It was all of a sudden I'm traveling on a bus and, you know, playing great festivals and things that I'd never played before. And I got the gig right with Kirk Fletcher. So we were like, you know, newbies together. And, June Corr in the band and Randy Bermudez. That was a fun band.
I don't know if I would have seen you. Like, I remember seeing Charlie Musselwhite in early 2000.
Yeah.
2003 or 4 at the Ottawa Blues Festival. Would you have been there? Kirk was there.
Then I must have been there. Because I joined around 2000. And, you know, I think 2003 or 2004 was my last years. But we toured Canada a couple times.
So when you play with somebody like Charlie Musselwhite, what do you learn?
Oh, just, you know, bigger audiences, did a lot of different styles of songs. You know, we had to do like a Cuban kind of beat on one song, and, you know, we had to rehearse quite a bit more. You know, I rehearsed with Rusty a fair play too, but I think just it was bigger rooms and a little more pressure somehow. I don't know.
But other than and the time you played with Rusty and thought I'm getting my ass kicked,
yeah.
Like by this time, are you pretty confident of your playing and your abilities?
I'm more confident, but until I got my ass kicked every night by Kirk Fletcher on the
but. I mean, they say it's best to be in a band, be the worst player in a band, right? Yeah.
But I, Kirk, boy, I mean, there was a very fluid and great guitar player whom I, you know, think of the world of. And I learned a lot. We, you know, we would talk about music a lot, and he would show me stuff, you know, what he listens to and everything. And he's got a very eclectic taste, just like Rusty does. And honestly, to just cut to the chase, I didn't really feel I became a great guitar player until my late 30s, until I joined John Namath's band. That's when I started to really feel like, oh, okay, I'm kind of liking what I'm playing now. And it just took me a while to get it, you know.
Explain that process. Like, what happens when you say, wow, I think I have it, or I think this is where I want to be?
I think record, you know, I would just sit at home and try to practice a lot of my own kind of stuff, you know, and of course I stole a lot from other people too, but I would work on solos and just try to play them note for note. And I just got more fluid, and I was doing the same thing with Rusty, but it just didn't start sounding good to me for some reason until my late 30s. And maybe it's just because I was relaxing. The guitar is different than the keyboards, you know. I feel like I did have, maybe I'm more of a naturally better piano player because it's easier to sound fluid on it, you know. At least for me, mm-hmm. than it was the guitar, yeah.
So am I correct to assume that you got the John Namath gig because Kit Anderson left the band? Is that the way it worked?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe he didn't leave the band, but... Because you were living at Greaseland. Because Kid talked about this on my interview with him, and he got
Kid's tenure with John Namath was very short, right. You know, and it's kind of like, you know, lore now. You know, everybody talks about, you know, Kid's drinking days,
right.
You know, and he after one night in I forget where we were in Washington, Kid managed to break a bathtub. And insult the club owner in the same night. So John had enough, you know.
So were you already in the band then?
I was playing bass because Junior Watson was also in the band.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was playing bass and, or maybe keyboards. I don't remember. I honestly don't remember. And, but I really wanted to play guitar, and I was playing with Mark Hummel, and, I joined up with John Namath, and once kid, you know, and I think John, I'd already done some gigs with John on guitar, and I think he liked my playing. So that worked out.
And then you feel comfortable playing guitar.
I did. But John also, you know, kind of broke me out of my shyness. You know, I remember one time he put a piece of tape at the end of the stage and he goes, "This is where I want you to stand when you solo." Like, okay, I just did whatever, you know, I wanted to learn, and I got into it, you know. And, but yeah, that was a lot of fun playing with John.
What a talent.
Yeah, I know.
So when he says, "Stand here, come up to closer to the front of the stage," how do you feel about that?
I was okay with it, you know. I knew he knew what he was talking about. And I was like, well, he's right, you know. In order for me to get over in the audience, you know, I'm going to have to like, you know, step it up a little bit, I suppose.
And was that an easy transition for you?
You know, at that point I was ready. So it wasn't so difficult. And, you know, he was just right. You know, he was right to tell me to stand up to the edge of the stage when you solo. And, but he was great to work with, you know? And, so yeah, I was just ready for it. I was ready to learn, and I was ready to have fun, you know?
Okay, so I think of you probably associate you with Alvin Bishop more than anybody else. How did that happen?
That happened, I met him on one of those cruises, you know? And he sat in with us, and I think I played piano and guitar with him, and he liked my playing, and he called me up about a year later to see if I could do a tour with him. But I couldn't, because I was already committed to John, you know. And but I really liked Elvin, you know. I was always been a fan, and I, you know, at the end of the year, I thought about it, like, well, shoot, if that position's still open, I wonder, you know, I kind of want to work with Elvin and see what that's like, you know. So I called him up and said, "Hey, man, can I be in your band?" And he said, "Yeah."
Wow.
Yeah.
No audition, nothing. Well, obviously, he liked you, right?
He liked me. I had to show up to his house and sit with him and show that I knew all his songs. And after that, I had the gig.
Yeah. What kind of preparation goes into that?
You know, the previous guitar player, Mike Shermer, who's a great guitar player, he made a tape for me of like, okay, here's all the parts to play behind. Because, you know, Elvin's like a mathematical genius, you know, and he comes up with all these sort of places on the guitar parts you wouldn't even think of. And I wouldn't have had a chance learning them, you know, just by listening to it, because I have no idea what he's doing.
Right.
So he was kind enough to show me all his parts, and I learned all the parts that way. And then, like, for the rhythm guitar parts, I tried to copy what Mike was doing, and Elvin's like, "No, don't do that," you know, because it wasn't natural. He's like, "Play like you on this thing." So I had to come up with my own parts as well. And but it, you know, it just took a couple of days of practice, you know, just practice for hours, and then it was rewarding, you know, because I learned all right.
I remember seeing you guys at the Southside Shuffle. I don't know what year it was, because I don't remember any years. But
yeah,
I mean, it was amazing. Like, it's just, you guys were on fire that night. I think it was, it might have been raining, but it was just, you know, just watching you guys on stage and just thinking, my God, Alvin Bishop is amazing. And I remember seeing you.
Yeah.
Like, just how, you know, I mean, he's obviously been around, but there's just something about witnessing a show that is so powerful, that is just, you know, a notch above the rest. It was quite something else.
That's how I always felt about Elvin and his band, you know, because he really is special, and he knows how to build songs, you know, and solos, and he, he's a great guy.
Yeah,
best band leader I've ever had. Great, you know, great guy.
My favorite thing is about him, when I asked him asked to interview him many, many years ago. I went to his record company, and then I got a phone call from him, and it was in Japanese, and my Japanese isn't very good, but this person said, "Are you Marco?" And he was speaking in Japanese, and I'm thinking, who is this? Nobody speaks to me Japanese. And it was Alvin Bishop. And because he had learned how to speak Japanese when he was 50, because somebody said you can't learn anything new when you're 50, and he said he would prove them wrong and learn Japanese, and he spoke way better than I did. So,
he can't wait to speak Japanese to somebody who can speak Japanese. So, you know.
Well, I would let him down on that one. But but so what is it like to, I mean, how, what's it like to play on stage with somebody who has that command of the stage and who can take the show to the next level? Is that something easy to learn?
No, I just, all the parts were relatively, you know, they weren't easy, but I got through them, you know. But the one thing I stumbled on was, like, you know, Elvin will give you a solo, but it's not like you go up there and you're gonna like shred for like 5 minutes. You just get like 12 bars, which is great. I love that, you know. And he said, listen, if you're not feeling inspired, since you only have 12 bars, it's better you come up with a solo that you can rely on and play it note for note should you not be inspired, you know? And so I was like, oh shit, I'm going to come up with my own solos. That's cool. And he taught me that a solo should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. The beginning is something bold you start with to get people's attention. And the middle is something to keep them interested in. And the end is something simple, like a turnaround, so they remember it. And I was like, oh shit, well, that's a great philosophy, you know? And so I did that, and I was like, wow, this is very rewarding. And you know, that way there's just kind of no room for error on stage, you know? And there's a lot of mistakes going on though anyway. Elvin's funny, man. Like there's a band with trombone player and percussion and drums and piano, and it's hard to keep that all together, you know. Sometimes things go awry, you know. Right. And Elvin and I have a lot of two guitar parts worked out, you know. And I think he was like that with all of his bands. He always has these two guitar parts worked out. But if anything goes wrong at any point, it can be a disaster, you know.
But it might be a disaster to you on stage, but to the most of the fan base who are watching, they probably have no idea that it's a disaster, correct?
Probably not, yeah, probably not. And Elvin's like really professional, you know, he just shrugs it off if anything happens, you know, he knows.
I can imagine. Okay, so the other person you've worked with a lot is Kim Olsen.
Yeah.
How did that happen? How did that begin? Yeah.
That I met him through Rusty once again, because Rusty used to play with
there's a connection here.
He used to play with Kim in his band. He recorded with him, you know, and I started playing with him back in the 90s, and I got a call to sub for Johnny Moeller on the guitar for the T-Birds back in 2016, just for like 3 gigs, you know.
Okay, so I always find this fascinating. So what is that like to get a call and say, you got to learn these songs. Johnny's not going to be around. Can you be the guitar player?
Yeah, I've seen this show. I've always been a fan of the T-Birds, so I was just excited. I was like, shit, I can't wait, you know? And so I practiced and got them all right and showed up to the gigs. And it was funny because I was playing through two super reverbs. At the end of the gigs, they're like, you know, you're not loud enough. And I'm like, what? Are you kidding? This is the loudest I've ever been in my life, you know? So, yeah, it was loud. But we were opening for the Doobie Brothers. So it was their arena, kind of, right. You know. It had to be loud. That made sense, you know.
So what's the difference between being the guitar player for Kim's blues band versus being a guitar player and keyboard player for the Fabulous Thunderbirds?
I would say just the songs are different. You know, I mean, the blues band, we're not doing Wrap It Up and Tough Enough and those songs. And I mean, yeah. And it, but in the blues band, we're doing like way more BB King and Magic Sam, a lot of more shuffles and slow blues, you know. It's just, Kim loves that stuff, so he doesn't ever want to give up playing it, you know. The T-Birds is a lot different. It's a lot more rocking and faster songs, you know.
But it's also not a set list.
No, not at all. Kim shoots from the hip. You have no idea what he's going to do next, which I really like, you know.
You like because the spontaneity?
It's spontaneity. It just kind of keeps it fresh, you know. And that's not to say I'm against set lists or anything. I understand that too. But it's just a different way of approaching it, you know?
And are you like, I always wonder, I presume because Kim is who he is and he's been around and he knows the stuff, that him calling out the show as he goes along, like realistically, he's not going to make a mistake and call out a song that was just not a good idea.
Right.
Like he knows this audience. He knows how the show should go. But does that ever happen where you think, well, that was a weird choice?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I first got in the T-Birds, it was a completely different band. Johnny Mohler wasn't there. I didn't know anybody. And it was all horns, you know? And we had like two sax players and a trombone player. And we're doing like all these old Bobby Bland tunes. And that sounded great. But the horn players were like jazz cats and they didn't really care for T-Bird songs very much, you know? So like having saxophone and trombone on the Tough Enough just didn't sound good, you know? And in my opinion, but I know everything else that sounded fine. So it was kind of like a strange experience because, and then, you know, Kim got rid of the horns and got Johnny back in there and, It feels great, you know. It feels like how it should be, you know. I suppose the horns were just, you know, they're great, you know. They're great to have them, but it just didn't work in this routine. Right. So that didn't work.
Yeah. Okay, so when you're up there playing with T-Birds, and I know this was before you officially joined, but opening up for the Doobie Brothers, in essence, this is your dream come true. That teenage kid, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly, it felt that way to me, you know.
That must be something else.
It felt really cool, man. I wasn't sure if I'd ever get to something like that, but I'm really grateful, you know.
And as a member of the T-Birds now, I presume you're experiencing something like that on a more regular basis.
Yeah, most of the places we play have seemed to sell out, and they're big crowds, and they know the songs, and, you know. And the rest of the band are just great and easy to get along with. And Kim's a great guy, man. And I like everything about it.
Yeah. And it's their 50th anniversary, right? So this is a big deal with a new album coming out.
Yeah, we got a record coming out, I think, in June. And it's got a bunch of special guests on it, like Bonnie Raitt and Elvin's on it. And Mick Fleetwood and Taj Mahal. Billy Gibbons, I think. And... cool songs. We're already starting to play some of them, but we'll see what happens.
So did that change your life to join this band? Like, is it any different to be in the Fabulous Thunderbirds than it would have been playing with Charlie Musselwhite or John Nemeth or Alvin Bishop? I mean, it is a little more rockier.
It is more rockier, and I really like that. I like getting up there and you know, playing the songs we do, you know. And Elvin was the same feeling, I think. He's just doesn't play as much as he used to, you know. And he has every right to be semi-retired and do whatever he wants, you know.
Right.
And playing with Charlie was a lot of fun, too. You know, the music. And John, you know. John deserves a bigger crowd, I think. But, he has big crowds, but, you know, he deserves everything those guys, you know, have, I think.
I mean, it's a pretty amazing resume you have when you think about those are the people you've played with for a very long time. I mean, starting with Rusty Zinn.
Yeah.
So what is it about you that gets you into these situations and continues to, that allows you to continually play with these people?
Well, I think playing both keyboard and guitar definitely helps, you know, because people think, oh, I get two in one, you know?
Right.
Kim and Elvin have both complimented me on my accompanying abilities. So I think I, starting with Rusty, you know, I learned how to accompany a singer in this genre of music very well, you know, on the piano and the guitar. So I think in the studio and on stage, it took me a long time, but I got there. So I think that's what keeps me busy.
Do you know, I know that everybody picks up an instrument and the goal is to hopefully one day sound like themselves, to have their own sound. And in your case, as a sideman, you have to basically accompany all these great musicians. Was it difficult to attain that sound of yours playing with so many different people?
Right off the bat, I've always kind of had my own sound, and I'm not trying to brag. As a matter of fact, it's because I can't mimic other people very well, you know? So I always end up sounding like me, you know, and I've practiced B.B. King solos and Otis Rush, you know, and I just always end up playing the way I do, you know, and I think I kind of, you know, at least I feel like I have kind of my own sound, but, you know, that's just because I'm not able to imitate other people in a way that I would like to, you know.
Okay, and then the other thing that you've been working on, and I don't know where it's at, but is a solo recording.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, many years ago, I went into the recording studio. I think it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, and I cut a bunch of songs at Greaseland Studios where I used to live.
Right.
And I had Kid playing bass on it. He's a fantastic bass player. And I had Marty Dodson playing drums, and I had June Corr on drums. And then I had Alabama Mike singing on it. And we recorded a bunch of songs, and after listening to it, like, shit, you know, some of this sounds pretty good, you know? And it's just so strange putting out an album these days, since I do consider myself more of a sideman than I do, you know, I don't really sing.
I mean, what made you start that project? What made you think, I need to do this?
Probably just wishing that I had something to sell on stage, you know, and also to I've always wanted to have a 45, you know. I remember when John Namath made a 45 of one of his songs on one of the records I did with him. And I thought, oh, this is the coolest thing. Because I love vinyl, you know.
Right.
So I want to have it for aesthetic reasons as well, you know. I'd like to have at least a 45 or an EP of maybe the songs I've done. And I've got really 8 good ones. I think we recorded like 12, but the other ones I don't know so much about. And then I did a bunch of recording with John Atkinson, and I'm hoping he maybe might give me a couple of those songs from his sessions and I can put a full record out, you know, if it was cohesive enough. I don't know. I'm not putting it out to promote myself, but I just want to put it out just to have something I can sell on stage, but also, you know, something, a collection of songs that I like that I think, you know, people might enjoy listening to, I hope.
And are these your own songs or are they covers?
They're all covers. I do like Universal Rock by Earl Hooker, you know. I love that instrumental. I've been doing it for years. And, well, that's the other reason why. It doesn't have enough piano songs on it, so I need to record some piano songs on there. People might be disappointed, you know. There's always recordings, you know.
I mean, the fact that you lived in Greaseland and you work closely with Kid, I mean, you do have access to a studio.
Yeah. I'm still only a half an hour away, you know, and he's very kind to let me, you know, I overdubbed a guitar part on the latest Fabulous Thunderbirds record over there. And, you know, kid's busy all the time, you know. Yeah. He's always got something going on. But it's great to know that he's over there.
How about writing? Has the idea of writing songs ever intrigued you?
You know, it used to. And I just got so caught up with doing what I do that I, you know, I've co-written songs with Rusty.
Of course. And Alvin.
I love coming up with guitar parts, but finishing completing songs is not something that I have really ever done, you know, on my own. Although I don't know if it's something I would ever do, but maybe.
Well, you've been so busy. Like, it's crazy when you thought that at one point that you would give up this business.
Yeah.
And you know, become an English lit person.
Yeah, tell me about it.
And then to score a gig with one of the greats, Charlie Musselwhite. And I'm not sure if since then you've ever considered quitting music, but it seems like you've had a pretty good run.
I haven't. I've still had a good run, you know, to this day. And there's nothing really else I can do. And I have no interest in going back to school. And I still have a musical journey ahead of me, I hope so.
Do you have goals at this point, musically?
You know, I'm just really want to play music live for the rest of my life. That's my goal. I want to just play with people that I like playing with and play for a big audience, you know? I don't know if I have goals or not, just to keep doing what I'm doing and doing it better. That's pretty much it. You know, I still practice, you know, I'm still serious about what I do, and I just want to keep being able to do it as long as I live.
Well, I think that's probably a good spot to end this, but okay. how do you get better? Like, how does that happen?
I think, trial by fire, you know, going out there and playing live and failing and learning from your mistakes and practicing, you know, and then once you eventually you hopefully feel like you're doing something right up there, you know, and I think that's the only way to learn, playing live.
I don't even know what that concept of failing would be in context of what you do. Does that even happen anymore?
I think, you know, there's a lot of soloing in blues, you know,
yeah.
And not all of it you might want to hear, you know, I'm speaking for myself, but not just everybody else. But I mean, like, it's a difficult thing. It's to get up there and intrigue people with what you're playing, you know, and, you're your own worst critic, you know, but, it just takes a lot of factors to get it right. And as far as failing, it's just not meeting up to your standards, or maybe, you know, not translating well, or who knows, you know, I take what I do seriously, and so does everybody else, I'm sure. But I mean, I think, practice makes perfect, and playing live is key. And I love what I do. So I'm, you know, very grateful.
Well, we're grateful that you do what you do, because you've been doing this for a long time and putting out some great music with some great musicians.
I'm very happy about the company I keep.
And you should be. Thank you so much for doing this, Bob. It was a real pleasure meeting you.
Likewise, pleasure meeting you. And I'm like you say, we probably met at the Silver Dollar.
Yeah.
In Toronto. And but it was a pleasure talking to you, man. Thanks for interviewing me.
And I'm hoping. I heard rumors that you might be coming this way in the summer, so I'm hoping that is true, and maybe I will see you.
I hope so. You know, I'll let you know. I'll let you know if we're playing in anywhere near you. And I know we're going to Canada in October. I'll keep you in the loop.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you again for doing this. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, man. Thank you.
You take care.
All right, you too.